Good afternoon. I am Richard Rowe, a trustee of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society. I welcome you to this online program on SEC Safe Harbor Rules. The Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society is a nonprofit organization separate and independent of the SEC. The Society preserves, shares the history and historic records of the SEC and of the securities industry through its virtual museum at www.sechistorical.org. Today's program will be preserved in the museum so you can listen to the discussion or read the transcript later. This online program on safe harbor rules has been coordinated by the Society's Corporation Finance Committee and is being offered today in tribute to Alan Levinson and Linda Quinn, two former directors of the Division of Corporation Finance, who passed away in 2003. I am a former director of the Division of Corporation Finance and now am practicing law in Washington, D.C. I will be the host and moderator of this program. I am joined by Edward H. Fleischman, a former SEC commissioner who served from 1986 to 1992 and who is now practicing law in New York City, and by Peter J. Romeo, SEC Division of Corporation Finance staff member from 1969 to 1984, who is now practicing law in Washington, D.C. Our remarks today are made solely on our own and are not representative of the Society. We cannot give investment or legal advice. Our topic is SEC safe harbor rules. There are at least two different types of safe harbor rules. Those that which are generally interpretive, that if followed, although not exclusive, will not result in a violation of specific provisions of the federal securities laws, generally the Securities Act of 1933. There are others that are generally provided by rule that under the SEC's exemptive authority that provide that a certain disclosure would not be subject to various provisions of the securities laws, in some cases the anti-fraud provisions. The theory of the latter type rule is it will encourage certain disclosures that might otherwise be provided. We will take SEC Rule 144 as our first example of the type of safe harbor that is interpretive in nature. Ed, what were some of the problems that you saw back in the time you were a practitioner in the late 60s and early 70s that gave impetus to the need for such a rule?
It comes down, Dick, to uncertainty. The problems that we all faced, whether we were lawyers or principals in the matter, of not having confidence in our ability, except in the very, very middle of the highway, to be able to give advice as to the legal consequences of resales, particularly of privately placed securities, but as well of securities that were held by controlling persons. And if I may take advantage of your question, I think that my reference to securities held by controlling persons is deliberate, because the Rule 154 literature, which now dates just about a decade before 144, and perhaps not quite that much, actually a decade and a half, the 154 literature has got two phrases that seemed to me to get us to what safe harbor rules are about. One is satisfactory objective circumstances. And I like the adjective particularly satisfactory, because that will take us into the so-called shoals in safe harbors. And the other phrase is a ready guide for routine cases. That actually is a phrase out of one of the SEC's 154 releases. But it seemed to me, in thinking about this program with you and Peter, that those two put them together, put together the essence of safe harbor rules. They are, I think, from the Commission's perspective, ready guides for routine cases. Whereas from what was then and is again my perspective of the private practicing bar, one tends to think of guides for not only the routine, but pretty much all but the exceptional cases. And one tends to think of objective circumstances without the satisfactory. The satisfactory importing a lot of history and lore and statutory interpretation. That goes back, at least to my understanding, at least as far as Alan Troop and Mr. Lane's article on exemptions back in 1937.
But, Peter, wasn't the staff at this time, weren't they issuing interpretive and no-action letters on resale of securities?
We were, Dick, and it was a very unsatisfactory process. We would get 5,000 to 6,000 letters a year, and the staff had this principle called the unforeseen circumstances approach, where if you hadn't held your securities for a relatively long period of time, proving that you were not an underwriter, you had not bought with a view to distribution, that the only way you could sell in advance of this lengthy period, 3 years or whatever, was to demonstrate you had unforeseen circumstances that happened to you. And I can tell you right now that never in my life did I understand that cancer was such a dominant factor in the healthcare system, because half the letters were, I got cancer, my wife got cancer, we have to sell, we couldn't have predicted this. And it was a tale of woe that no one cared to see. And the worst part was the staff was required, in essence, to perform a godlike function. You know, this one is okay, that one's not okay, where do you split the hairs? It was very difficult, and of course there were timing constraints as well. People had to wait for a staff letter. So there were a lot of reasons why it wasn't a good situation.
And from the perspective of the private bar at the time, it was not the unforeseen, which would have given Peter and his colleagues trouble enough. It was the staff's insistence that it be unforeseeable. And the questions that arose as to whether, you know, I'm making one up, but whether the genealogy of the family was such that they should have predicted that somebody was going to get cancer.
Well, I think the staff took a rather strict position. And the other problem was that no one knew exactly what the standards were, because nothing was published on this. You wrote in and got your own letter, but no one else really knew about it. Now, the New York firm sort of passed these letters around, and they were kind of in the know, but if you were outside of the big New York firms, you didn't know what the standards were. You were kind of guessing. So there was a need for some guidance out there, whether a safe harbor or some sort of interpretive release or whatever, but something was badly needed. And 144, of course, ultimately proved to be a tremendously good solution to the problem.
What Peter says is very important. Except for the occasional footnote, as in the Silver Anniversary editions, one really didn't know what the no-action letters were. The memoranda in our files that are footnoted in the 1959 periodicals were the first notions that many of us had of the process.
What periodical are you referring to, Ed?
There were two Silver Anniversaries. The one I have with me is Virginia. The other one is George Washington University Law Review. But they were... They were seminars in securities law, both of them. Peter also leads one to the problem that is cited as well in the Wheat report, the notion that since all these things were interpretations of intention, with the intention to distribute, the idea got currency that one had to have some kind of indefinite intention to hold the securities being purchased in many of these private transactions, so that the very inquiry, when may I sell, was famous for the answer, now that you've asked that question, you clearly have an intent to distribute. And I think that was memorialized in an article by, it was a Chicago, very well-known Chicago lawyer, but not Ray Garrett. And in a poem that I think is quoted in the Weed Report.
The commission in those days did not have exemptive authority, so that they couldn't just propose an exemptive rule and that would be the end of it.
No, but they had, as they still do, the authority that Peter used very effectively and imaginatively to define technical trade and accounting terms. And one of the Weed Report comments has to do with the commission's authority to adopt this kind of rule, which from today's perspective is a kind of a strange question. Ça va sans dire. But in 1969, it wasn't strange at all.
Well, I think it's rather difficult in today's light to look back 35 years to 1969 and understand what the landscape was back then. There was no precedent for this sort of thing. This was truly a revolutionary type of approach.
Only if you think of it as exemptive. In 59, the notion of taking the same term, underwriter, the same fundamental term, and defining it through a rule, the old rule 155, expansively to catch more people was taken without any question. It was just the notion of using it to restrict the number of persons who would be subject to the statute that might have been new.
But hasn't that always been a tension between opening up, permitting capital to be raised or securities to be resold, and the concerns that you're going to have abuses, people are going to take advantage of these rules, and the whole concept of filing a form is in part based on we need some handle on what's going on. Otherwise, we'd never know what's going on. Now, whether the commission has used that form for those purposes or not is another question. But.
Well, you raise a point, though, that has kind of surprised me over the years, how far the commission has gone down the Safe Harbor Road. We started out with Rule 144 that said very objective standards for resales under the 33 Act. And I can remember Stanley Sporkin often saying, when the question would come up, well, let's define the term inside information or insider trading or whatever, and Stanley would say, no, we're not going to do that because then we'll give people a roadmap to fraud because they'll know, all I got to do is go beyond that, stay within the confines of that definition, I'm fine. And I've seen the commission, as we all know, now adopt Rule 10b-5-1, which, of course, is a safe harbor from anti-fraud liability. Now we have a more recent addition, Rule 13A11, another safe harbor from anti-fraud liability for non-filings on 8K of certain information that will become effective in August. So there's been quite a transformation and a movement forward of this whole process.
But occasionally there is a need to move backwards. I recall that when Regulation S, which is an interpretive rule actually, was first adopted, and there was no provision in the rule that dealt with the flowback of securities offered overseas back into the United States, so that lawyers were put to using the old lore to determine when that could happen. And it turned out that, at least in the eyes of the SEC, and probably they were right in this case, there were a lot of abuses by U.S. companies selling securities abroad or ostensibly selling securities abroad and then redistributing them immediately or shortly thereafter in the United States. And Reg S was amended to put a stop to that, or at least to put limits on it.
It was amended. The whip was cracked, and practitioners and their clients were warned that these practices would be interpreted in a different way. Well, abuse, do you remember the abusive practices release?
Yes.
It wasn't necessary with 154 or 144. There was some little bit of it around Reg D, but not to the extent that that crept up in Reg S. And with an acknowledgement that I was a commissioner at the time that Reg S was adopted, I think the failure is on the part of the draftsman, analogizing to our practice and to the way courts look at a document. It is read against the draftsman. If the commission, including me and the staff at the time, did such a poor job on Reg S as to allow that much of a gaping hole, then it seems to me the commission shouldn't have been surprised. The staff shouldn't have been surprised with what happened. That's the other side of a coin that private practitioners have been talking about for at least 40 years. Let me read you a quote from one of those 1959 Silver Anniversary articles. We suggest that the blunderbuss approach, that is, to cover everything lest a single crook or one unscrupulous lawyer get away with something, has proved unnecessarily costly. That has been, from the private bar's point of view, a problem with the drafting of many of the safe harbor and exemptive rules. Reg S is the opposite exception, and the only thing I can say is that we were all a bit asleep at the switch.
Well, the commission, I think, has demonstrated great flexibility with the safe harbors. 144 is clearly the prime example, because you started out with a rule that was rather stringent at the beginning in terms of holding period requirements and volume limitations and how much you could sell and so forth. And as time went by, those major requirements were relaxed somewhat because experience had demonstrated the market could allow for more to be sold at shorter intervals and so forth. And the commission, to its credit, showed that it was willing to relook at these rules and not allow them just to be static and not be that useful after a time.
But there are suggestions that they're going to go back and relook at some of those relaxations because of the dynamics in the marketplace where you can use derivatives and other devices to achieve the economies of a sale without actually selling the the rights to the securities.
Well, that has been one particular piece of that rule that has given the commission problems, perhaps from the very beginning. The notion that one had to have paid for the securities, if you remember, and then that the clock would not tick if any of the, not only if any of the securities hadn't been paid for in full, but if there were any offsetting, what you might call now hedge, or what were then called short positions, that was then reconsidered in the manner mm-hmm. that Peter suggests, and that was deliberately stricken in order to purge the rule of any vestiges of fungibility, as I remember, but deliberately, and then within just a few years, the consequences of that action, aggravated perhaps by the developments in the in the marketplace vis-a-vis derivatives, have turned it back around, and people, as you say, are concerned. There's this matter in the newspapers of the enforcement division wanting to take a kind of a street-wide look at how insiders have used derivatives to avoid the strictures and the reporting requirements that go with not only with Rule 144 but are included in 144.
Well, I question whether I saw that article. In fact, I was called to comment on it, and I'm quoted in it in a very small way. But I question, at least in my own experience, whether indeed they are being used to evade reporting requirements. It may well be true, but I haven't seen that in my own experience. And I question whoever it was that was quoted in that article who said that some people give advice, you don't have to report those. That's not correct, I don't believe.
Well, I'm not sure whether Ed was talking about filing a form that says I'm selling the securities or filing a a Form 4 report under the 34 Act. If you're an insider, you have to report the acquisition or disposition of a derivative security.
Right.
So I agree with Peter on that one, but they're not getting the Rule 140, Form 144s in many of these transactions. But I question whether there is harm there, as Peter does. Another aspect of many of these rules, and Ed touched on this, and maybe you two can comment on it, but many of them have introductory notes, which are sort of a roadmap to the rule itself. And those introductory notes, in many of the rules, 144 is a perfect example, they say this rule is not available if for any scheme to evade the registration provisions of the Act, and also that, you know, it's not an exemption from the anti-fraud provisions, obviously. That's an interesting provision, and I think it goes to what Ed was saying. The routine transactions are covered by this rule, but if you're in a non-routine transaction, tread carefully.
Well, the notion of the preliminary notes themselves has always fascinated me. I had, in a conversation with you, as I remember, I attributed that to Alan Levinson, to whom, in part, this particular program is dedicated. I find, and it may not detract from Alan, but I find that the Wheat Report itself, that is to say, 3 and 4 years before Rule 144 was proposed, suggested the use of preliminary notes in the 160 series, as it was then to be called. It has always seemed to me, without understanding what either Frank Weed or Alan had in mind, that a consequence is that these notes become part of the Code of Federal Regulation. And to the extent that they are out there not only as guidelines for practitioners, but to the extent that they represent the possibility that matters under these rules may come into dispute, a judge who picks up the CFR will find those notes, and they go well beyond the words of the rules that follow. They particularly in 144, the notion of what underlay the determination of how the determination that someone was not to be considered an underwriter. The need, for example, to preserve the essence of the 33 Act in the information disclosure requirements. I mean, what was paragraphs C actually doing in that rule is explained in the notes, and wouldn't otherwise have been explained. I do agree with you that the scheme to evade language is difficult to conjure with as a practitioner. I put it in that category of satisfactory objective conditions. Satisfactory to the commission on an after-the-fact look. But the commission had in the 50s lived through an era of persons seeking to take advantage of the exemptive process, or seeking to hide behind the exemptive process. Cases like the Ira Haupt case, and what was the name of the fellow? Louis Wolfson.
Wolfson, yeah.
So the scheme to evade language, it seems to me, is not strange in the immediate context. And as I say, a lot of these ideas go all the way back to Troop and Lane, in the very first years reflected in the 1937 article.
You know, you raise an interesting point, though, about that it can't be a scheme to evade. As we all know, having gone through the rulemaking process, all divisions have input into what's being proposed. And in some cases, a division or an office can be kind of a stopper in the process, like the Division of Enforcement, unless certain things are included in a rule. And I know for a fact on Rule 144 that there are provisions in there that were demanded by the Division of Enforcement. 144K, which requires this three-month waiting period after you cease to be an insider before you can take advantage of 144K, I guarantee you that was straight out of Stanley Sporkin. I'm not saying it wasn't a good idea. I think it probably was. But it also brings up another point about safe harbor provisions, which is that the commission need not track the exact requirements of the particular exemption that they're providing the safe harbor for. They can insert their own conditions in there, saying this is the price you pay for going down this road. If you want to get absolute safe harbor protection, you got to do everything in here, including some things that we think are essential but may not have been thought of by the drafters of the particular statutory provision.
Peter used the word absolute safe harbor protection. I think we would agree that there is no absolute in any of the safe harbors. You started, I think, perhaps your very first question to me had to do with the no-action process. And to Peter, how often did he have to address the change of circumstances type of argument in the pre-144 days? remember, however, that once 144 got out there, a five-foot shelf of books of no-action responses built very quickly. That has to be, in retrospect, an evidence of the fact that there were soft places in the rules that that once applied, perhaps in non-routine transactions, or once sought to be applied, had to be interpreted to for inclusion or exclusion, for meeting the requirements or failing to meet the requirements. And the notions of shoals in the safe harbor, though not necessarily vis-a-vis 144, to my recollection, but certainly in the very first of the private placement rules, which wasn't 240, it was 146.
146. Wasn't it?
Yeah, the bar was at the time very, very articulate, as I remember, about the difficulties and uncertainties that the rulemaking brought with it, replacing the difficulties and uncertainties that had preceded the rule.
Well, it's interesting that maybe we move on to Regulation D as another example of a safe harbor, but there you have the example of the form that the rule requires that you file, because I remember, as Peter remembers, the Division of Enforcement at one time, and when the commission was prepared to do away with the filing of the form, at one time the Division of Enforcement insisted, no, you can't do away with the form. Well, it's a little bit like when the Japanese, under Douglas MacArthur in 1945 or 1946, adopted securities laws. They adopted Section 16B of the 34 Act, which is a profit recapture provision. But the Japanese, wily as they are, didn't adopt Section 16A, which is the reporting provision. So maybe the enforcement had something up their sleeve. But it's interesting the way the commission dealt with that, because while it's a requirement, it is not a condition to the exemption under the rule.
Ah, but it was.
It was. But they withdrew when they couldn't do away with the form. They said, "Okay, we won't." But
those were two separate actions.
All right.
The failure to do away with the form was at one time period, and the removal of the filing of the form as a condition came from a different initiative. At a different time.
Well, let's
Again, if the commission were to bring an action against somebody for failure to file the form, that could preclude them going forward from using the exemption. To my knowledge, they've never done that.
No.
Let's talk for a moment, if it's all right with you two, about the form requirement of Rule 144. You know, that's, again, a requirement that you must satisfy if you pass the thresholds for the amount you're selling in order to be able to rely on the rule. And I think we've all experienced situations where the form was not filed when the order was given, as the rule says it must be. And yet there seems to be nobody who really checks on this down at the commission or seems to care much, to be perfectly honest. But what do you do when somebody comes to you a week or so after a trade and says, gee, I forgot to file that form. What should I do? I have an answer, but I'm curious to hear what your answer is.
I don't know that I'm going to go near that one this afternoon.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. These are safe harbors, except for one provision of Rule 144, which was for a while exclusive and no longer is. They're not exclusive means for compliance. And one answer you could give in a situation that's appropriate, routine, and small enough so that nobody is going to be hurt too badly, just say, all right, rely on another, on the statute. Yes, the statute provides that you can,
right.
you can sell securities if you're not an underwriter or a dealer.
It's a funny provision that Peter asks about, though, because that, as I understand it, that particular form has taken on an economic function over the years. Almost immediately, it was talked about as a shadow that should be followed by the analyst community and by quant analysts particularly. But it has taken on a function, and I don't mean by combination with the Section 16 report that often follows, but just as an indication, supposedly contemporaneous or in advance, of sell side sentiment by insiders, whether they be inside officers or whether they simply be insiders in the sense of holding restricted securities. And the markets have made something more important of that, I think, than it was originally anticipated to be. And therefore, I have a little bit more difficulty saying to a client, well, forget it.
depending upon the situation, the Form 144 is transmitted to the Commission when you place the order. That means transmitted by the United States mail is an appropriate way to do that. Nowadays, the insider, at least, is filing an electronic report of sales within two business days. So the electronic report may get there well before the other report.
Yes.
And it's much more accessible. God knows where the 144 forms go.
Well, a time may be coming where they make that an electronic filing obligation as well.
I would assume so. If they keep it, I would assume so.
Yeah.
Keep it.
Maybe we could deal with some of the other types of safe harbor rules that actually protect against liability or remove liability. And one comes immediately to mind is that, and this again comes out of the Wheat Report, that the financial part of the quarterly report that we all know as Form 10-Q is not a filed document for purposes of the liability provisions of the 34 Act. And the thought behind that, I think, was we'll encourage people to file, this is something they've never done before. We'll give them a little bit of slack in doing it. And the Commission has never really focused on that.
Because 10b-5 and that oak tree has so replaced Section 18 of the 34 Act. Section 18 is a mighty small faggot on that very large fire.
Well, but the Commission quite frequently said, look what we're giving you. We're exempting you from Section 18. And there's actually a case in the District Court case in the District of Columbia where the District Court misread the rules and said that was an exemption from 10b-5.
Yeah.
Now, if there had been a preliminary note, I would have understood.
Well, since we're talking about 10b-5, I'd like to talk about one aspect of 10b-5-1, which is the safe harbor for trading plans and the like. I was rather surprised, to be honest, and continue to be surprised, that the Commission said in interpretation that it's perfectly okay to have a trading plan and decide, once you get some inside information, to revoke that trading plan on the basis of that inside information. And it strikes me that that is something that allows an insider to do, whereas he couldn't do it otherwise through a trade. And why should you allow him to do that under a safe harbor provision? In effect, he's avoiding a loss.
He's
avoiding a loss. And that's sort of verboten in terms of doing a purchase or sale. And, of course, the theory here is there is no actual purchase or sale by just deciding not to trade. But you're still taking advantage of inside information in the trading arena. And I find that to be really difficult to understand why the commission would allow that. Why couldn't they just make that a condition for the safe harbor?
Well,
you cannot use inside information.
I can take the other side. First of all, the Supreme Court of the United States has said there has to be a purchase or sale. The Supreme Court of California has said otherwise. But because every day the insider with the information is, in a sense, taking advantage of it if it's because they're deciding not to sell. Or arguably they're deciding not to sell. It's not too much of a stretch to go to the safe harbor rule and say, well, we may not like it.
But you are in a safe harbor context, as Peter is, I think, raising the question. Shouldn't this be one of those instances in which the commission says, if you want the advantage of this safe harbor,
right,
you can't back away from it in order to avoid a loss that you know you would otherwise have? Or avoid a missed profit, but it's always on that side, isn't it?
Yes, but then what does the commission charge this person with? Other than the loss of the safe harbor, what is this person going to be charged with? There was no purchase or sale. The Supreme Court says you can't do anything to me.
Well, you lose the benefit of the rule for the purchases or sales that you did make. In other words, you didn't have the safe harbor. If you do that, you lose it.
Retroactively?
No, at least prospectively. I don't think you can do it retroactively.
Well, I think you're probably right about that.
Well, if it's prospective, yes, I can understand. You can say if you do this, assuming.
But then you'd let them do what the rule says they can't do, revoke it.
You lose the
safe harbor. I just have a problem. I don't mean to dwell on this unnecessarily, but.
No, it's an interesting aspect of it because while I happen to think that's what the rule provides, I am as surprised as you are that the commission would admit that.
Yeah.
But that's a different issue.
Yeah.
Other types of safe harbor. Let's move from the 33 Act and the anti-fraud provisions to.
Well, before we leave the 33 Act, I want to talk about a pet peeve of mine.
Okay.
And that is the integration safe harbors, which are scattered throughout the various rules under the 33 Act. And I don't have a problem with the safe harbor, you know, the five-factor test and so forth itself, but I have found recently, in the last year or so, that those safe harbors, the integration safe harbor, is being interpreted much more narrowly and strictly by the staff than I've been led to believe was the general approach of the staff to that area. In many ways, the staff seems to me to be applying the integration safe harbor in a rather wooden fashion and not looking in all cases at the surrounding circumstances and who really needs protection here. I've seen the staff apply it in a circumstance where the person that needed protection, quote, needed protection, was a person who clearly knew everything that was going on with the company. In one case, was a former founder, was a founder who was no longer associated with the company. And it's an aspect of all the safe harbor rules that has to be taken into account, and that is that the staff can interpret them narrowly or broadly, depending on how they choose to apply them. So I guess that's one cautionary note to take into account with respect to any safe harbor, but particularly so with respect to integration these days, I think.
I've had similar experiences, but I can understand, although maybe they're wrong, they probably are. I can understand why the staff is doing this because techniques for distributing securities are changing so rapidly and new techniques are being developed, and there are some abuses going on. And historically, the staff and this is not in the context of interpretation of when somebody asks for a letter, but this is in the process, I assume, of reviewing a registration statement, where you don't have very much way to appeal that. I mean, you're sort of stuck with it. Mm-hmm. Either you persuade them that they're wrong, or persuade them that at least let us go forward, even if you won't agree with us. You don't have much choice.
But let me be lawyery here. We're not talking about safe harbor rules anymore. You know, the only rule that I remember is actually the six-month period that's in 502 of Reg D. What Peter's really talking about is a set of interpretations that goes back to release 4552. Is that the right number?
Yes, that's right.
And that are repeated in notes to rules, but not in the rules themselves. They are only interpretations. Only interpretations. They are interpretations. They are as flexible as interpretations. They are rubbery. The five individual pieces are rubbery. And when put together, aside from the 6 months, they give you very little by way of safe harbor.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, Ed. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, the correct. 6 months, on the other hand, is 6 months. And the 30 days that is used in one context in the hedge fund report just several months ago is 30 days. I mean, that's a objective circumstance. Maybe not satisfactory for all purposes, but
there's a similar rule for abandoned offerings.
Yes, right. 155.
Which is a 30-day... Actually, you can shorten the 30 days under certain circumstances if you go through certain hoops. So mm-hmm. It's, again. I think all of this shows the flexibility. I mean, sometimes you may not want the staff to have all of that flexibility, but these rules are flexible. And if they become inflexible, the commission has over the years revised them to make them more flexible, for the most part.
The commission and its staff have over the years been responsive to at least to the gathering roar of resentment that comes every so often about particular inflexibility in a particular area.
Well, you're never going to please everybody, and the staff's got a difficult role to play, but I think they do a terrific job. You know, there are occasional areas where you might have some reason to question why they're doing, taking a particular approach or whatever. But I think overall, I think you all would agree as well, that they generally do a very fine job in terms of administering these rules and making them really work.
Thank you. All right, now we can move to the 34 Act, Peter. Another example would be the safe harbor for issuers repurchasing their own securities, which is a valuable safe harbor, Rule 10b-18, and it's done away with a lot of uncertainty, as Ed pointed out. That's one of the real problems. But
that was the uncertainty of, am I not correct, of direct SEC intervention on the assertion of some kind of Section 9 or Section 10 manipulation charge. If memory serves, its predecessor took a full 13 years from proposal to adoption. On the other hand, it is notorious as an example of what Peter was talking about, the staff's imaginative use of its own authority. It's notorious for its for the staff's public statement on October 19 or 20, 1987. If you want to go in the market, go in the market. We are not going to hold you to the every jot and tittle of the various provisions of what was then the safe harbor, encouraging issuers for the benefit, as it was then seen, of the greater marketplace. And it was the staff was credited with appropriate initiative on that score.
And the commission after 9/11 relaxed the rules on issuer repurchases also. Mm-hmm. So another example of the commissioner and or the staff reacting as they probably should. Mm-hmm. In particular situations.
But they have you mentioned one on which there have always been questions of detail as to whether the particular restrictions embodied in the rule are one necessary or two appropriate. Should the time period at the beginning and the end of the day be shorter or longer or there at all? Are the volume restrictions appropriate in various in the time frames to which they apply? That's almost a it's an area in which the marketplace activities, the initiatives in the market, the way the market functions is what I'm trying to get at, have a great deal to do with the appropriateness of the provisions of the rule and vary with market conditions from time to time. A matter to which the neither the commission nor the staff could possibly be expected to be able to address.
You know, 10b-18 is an interesting situation because, in my experience at least, it's often used in conjunction with another safe harbor, 10b-5-1, in the sense that you may set up a repurchase plan having certain parameters, give those parameters to your broker and say, do this within the confines of 10b-18. But make sure the price is never above a certain point and you don't buy any more than X number during a day or whatever. And we had a situation recently where doing that, combining 10b-18 with 10b-5-1, resulted in a situation where the broker, through a mistake, actually went over the limit for the amount and the price that could be satisfied. So it was kind of a problem here. I haven't had to deal with it. I'm going to tell you how it turned out, but I just want to mention that this is one of those unusual circumstances where two safe harbors can be joined at the hip.
But again, they're safe harbors, so that if yes. you go over a particular limit, depending upon the circumstances, obviously, but if you go over the limit, you still haven't necessarily committed a manipulative act.
Right.
The commission has proposed to amend 10b-18 to reflect more current conditions. Hopefully, yet it will not take 13 years this time. but the interesting thing is that the price that we may get for a little bit more relaxation is that there's going to be more disclosure of issuers repurchasing of their shares, and not only in 10b-18, but under any circumstances. So.
Well, I always thought that was a deficiency in 10b-18, to be honest with you, that there was no disclosure requirement there. I think most people did make disclosure anyway, but to me it should have been an actual condition of the rule.
Some people made disclosure and then never made any purchases.
That's true.
Well, both of those happened. And at the same time, the next time there was a filed statement of changes in the capital accounts, whatever transactions actually took place were reflected in financials filed with the commission.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, I kept in my copy of the appeal book a record of the various changes that had been made in different places, and there was an in and out. The commission over time has required that kind of disclosure by issuers. And then withdrawn the requirement because the conclusion had been reached over a decade or however period of time that it really wasn't material to the marketplace. And then market conditions change, or at least the perception is that there's been a change, and the requirement goes back in again.
Could we, in the few minutes we have left, maybe go to safe harbors that have failed? And there have been a few. but the one that springs immediately to mind, it failed in its purpose at least, are the series of rules that protect forward-looking statements. And I'm speaking of the rules before the statutory amendments eight years or so ago. But the purpose of these rules was to encourage companies to, in filings with the commission in particular, to make forward-looking statements, and it never really they never really accomplished their purpose.
It was at a time in the mid-70s when there was a growing realization, am I not correct, that the desire of the investing public was not only to know what the company did yesterday, but the investment decision-making was on the basis of what it was anticipated the company would do tomorrow. That blinding flash of insight only took 40 years, and only took Homer Kripke, article after article, and Carl Schneider, article after article of trying to persuade the commission. But the liability for the failures has always been the failures. The liability for the actual as compared to the projected, and particularly for the points at which the actual did not accomplish what the projected suggested was accomplishable, has, as you well know, long frightened off lawyers and their clients. There was a time when for new companies, at least the next 18 months had to be included in the first, in the IPO. New small companies, mm-hmm. am I not correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't even know whether that's true anymore. I've done one of those for too long. But everybody knows that the actual will not be what the projected is. The question is whether you get some kind of cornucopia-shaped area, and as long as you come within the area, you get some kind of protection. The words of Rule 175 never gave me any comfort that allowed me to advise a client to go out on that limb.
I'm more cynical than you are, Ed. I think that the company, you're right, the safe harbor had shoals in it, and why risk the shoals when there are other ways you can get your projections out? I mean, that's the reality of the situation was they didn't need to put them in commission filings. They could get them out in some other manner.
But they do get them into the 13E3s and 13E4s, don't they?
Into the
going private type transactions?
Because the commission, in a reversal of a longstanding position, forces them to do that.
Yes.
If there are, they don't force them to create them, but they do force them to put them in if they were created.
Yes.
Well, I'm going to offer a rather heretical thought on the whole idea of projections. As we all know, for 40 years, they were basically prohibited in securities law filings. And now, of course, they're encouraged, and you can't really operate as a public company without giving projections. But I'm not so sure that the commission wasn't right for those 40 years, to be honest with you, where they were trying to stifle projections and so forth. How many times have we seen companies, even on short-term projections, have to issue some sort of missive halfway through the period saying, oh, my God, we're going to miss our targets? I mean, I don't know whether it's more often than not, but it happens a lot. And the market relies on these, and I don't know why, to be honest with you, because projections are a guess in the end, an educated guess, hopefully, in all instances. But bottom line is they're not exact. They're often wrong, many times considerably wrong. And yet, I mean, that's just the way the marketplace functions. I'm not saying you can change it, but I think – the commission's discouragement or projections maybe wasn't such a bad idea. As I said, it's heresy.
But forward-looking statements cover much more than projections, and the commission, in its management's discussion and analysis, requirements or interpretations or
yes.
or staff prodding are trying to get more and more forward-looking statements. And the MD&A is covered by the SEC's rules and presumably in part covered by the statutory provisions.
And the notion in the 1989 MD&A release that that we really are not mandating forward-looking information has gone by the boards.
Yeah. Well, the type of information Dick is talking about, you know, trends and that sort of thing, that obviously is critical information, and that should be in there. What I was getting at was the actual numbers. You know, we're going to hit this number, that number, whatever. That's troublesome to me.
Alan Levinson used to talk about ranges, didn't he? Rather than specifics.
Oh, sure, but some of these projections, or many of these projections, are in ranges. I mean, we'll be between 51 and 52.5 cents.
Understood. I think that gets down to a theological rather than a legal argument.
I agree with you, yes.
Do you believe in grace, or do you believe in hellfire and damnation? I mean, if you assume that the at least the substantial minority of persons running issuers will abuse projections for their own benefit in the marketplace, then you get one answer to that, and it's Peter's answer. And if you assume that at least a substantial minority will play it straight and will be wrong most of the time but will still play it straight, you get a different answer. It still becomes the information that investors want more than anything else. It is, to use the SEC's phrase in a different in the MD&A context, it is in fact seeing the company through the eyes of management. What does management expect?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a few minutes we have left. Ed, you have 1 minute. Peter, you have 1 minute, and I have 1 minute.
Well, I use mine as I used in my response to your first question. I think what we're talking about is. Now I'm going to have to remember the exact phrase. Satisfactory objective circumstances that are supposed to be guides for routine cases. If seen that way, the safe harbor tool delivers its promise. And I include myself in this group, I think the bar has always seen it as more and broader, and therefore always been offended by the fact that some of the objective circumstances are clearly not satisfactory, and that the guides should go to more than routine cases. And we, as a bar, I think we've been disappointed in the safe harbor rules. Perhaps we oughtn't to be, but I think we have been.
Well, I'd have to disagree a little bit, Ed, in the sense that I think overall the safe harbors have been successful. I think back to life before they became a reality, and I think it's better now that we have those, and we have guides that we can look to and say, if I fit within these boundaries here, I'm going to be okay. I know absolutely for sure, it's like what you're saying about not being absolute, but I know that I should be safe here, and I think that's a tremendous way for the securities laws to operate. The more you can reduce the uncertainty, I think the better off you are. So I think they're a great idea. I think generally they've been executed well by the commission, maybe not as well as we all would have preferred, but generally well.
Well, I get the last word. Ed and Peter, thank you for a good discussion of safe harbor rules. And to our audience, just a reminder, today's program is now archived in the Society's Virtual Museum, so you can listen to it again and again and again. a transcript of today's program will soon be posted in the museum. Now, for the Society's next online program, That will be self-regulation in the exchanges from an historical perspective, live from New York City on Thursday, April 15th, from 4 to 5:30 Eastern Daylight Time. Hopefully, it will be daylight time by then, with William Brodsky, Alger Chapman, Gordon Macklin, William Morton, and Donald Stone. Please join us, and thank you for being with us today.